We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight we are talking about Ultraviolet. Oh, no, wait. I bet you thought we were done with Ultraviolet, didn't you? Because we did finish Ultraviolet. But in fact, there is one more sordid chapter in this story. And that is the sordid chapter of the American pilot, an attempted series in the U.S. And because this may be difficult for you to find, my summary is a little more in detail so that you will have a little better idea of what's going on in this story if you aren't able or not willing to seek it out on YouTube and watch it. Ultraviolet, the U.S. pilot. Jack, now Vigo, is an ex-undercover cop who is getting married in the morning to Kirsty. No, Neely. But he's mixing it up with some hookers. His best friend and best man, John, drags him out of the arms of the girls and sends him home. Jack, now Vigo, decides to walk home. It's only 7 blocks, after all. He is picked up by a pasty man in a car. The next day, Jack, now Vigo, is being taken to his wedding by the pasty man, but a car accident and an incident of road rage causes pasty man to spontaneously combust, crippling a motorcycle rider in the incident. Jack, no, Vigo, is accused of stealing all the evidence from the Garcia case. Don't ask me how to pronounce that one. That one just fumbles along for it. And doing a runner. Mike, no, John, meets Vaughn, no, Vaughn, who is a federal agent with a crucifix. He's a hard case, but Mike, no, John, doesn't believe it for a second. A co-worker of Mike, no, sorry, John, gets him the file that Vaughn, was working on. It's the accident Vigo, was in. The victim was taken way uptown to a Catholic hospital. Now Mike, no, that's John, goes to see the victim, who is spouting a wild tale about the driver catching on fire when the sunlight touched him. He confirms that Jack, no, Vigo, was in the car. Mike, no, John, meets Angie, no, Lise, the motorcyclist doctor, who seems to be trying to put Mike, no, John, off the scent. Later, Mike, no, John, sees Angie, no, Lise, meet Vaughn, no, Vaughn, in the hospital and enter a secret room together. Mike, no, John, investigates the car in broad daylight and meets Jack, no, Vigo, who pleads with him to tell Kirsty, no, Neely, that he's dead, but he doesn't deny that he stole the evidence against Garcia. That night, a beautiful woman turns up in the hospital and starts to talk about helping the paralyzed motorcyclist. She seems to want to kiss his neck. Mike, no, John's colleague gets him info on Angie, no, Lise, and says she's a CDC hematologist. She also reports that the motorcyclist got up and left the hospital, punching someone on the way. Mike, no, John, goes to investigate, and the motorcyclist runs into the subway, giving the slip to Mike, no, John, by losing him when he can't see him in the mirror. In the control room, on video, he sees Vaughn, no, Vaughn, on the platform. He investigates, and from across the tracks, he sees him holding the motorcyclist at gunpoint. A train goes between them, and Vaughn, no, Vaughn, shoots him, the body disappearing. Later, watching the video, Mike, no, John, watches the bizarre killing where no victim is visible. Later, we see Jack, no, Vigo, with the ailing pasty man and two beautiful women, freely giving his blood to the pasty man. He tells him he must decide soon, and that Kirsty, no, Neely, will follow him over, just as this blonde followed him centuries ago. For true love. Mike, no, John, now breaks into the secret room under the hospital, and after being captured by thugs, Angie, no, Lise, explains the whole story to him, and they let him go. Mike, now, John, reviewing the stag party video, sees that the girls Jack, no, Vigo, were mashing on are missing from the videotape. He goes to the agency that supplies them and tries to shake the owner down by hauling him into the sunlight. That doesn't work because he's not a vampire. But it looks like Vaughn, no, Vaughn, wants to kill him. Angie, no Lise, wants him on their side. Mike, no John, tracks down Jack, no Vigo, and meets the bunch of vampires. He lets them go because Jack, no Vigo, is his friend, and he has a pointlessly useless weapon on him anyway. Vaughn, no Vaughn's hit squad, arrive, and most of them are killed. But not Jack, no, Vigo, and one of the girls. Now, Jack, no Vigo, confronts Mike, no John, one last time, and Mike, no John, tells Jack, no Vigo, to stay away from Kirsty, no Neely, or he'll kill him. Afterwards, Angie, no Lise, tries to talk him into joining them, and also that night, Jack, no Vigo, turns up at Kirsty, no Neely's bedroom. They embrace. The end. Why did they change the names of everyone but Vaughn? What were they thinking? Vigo? Who has ever met a human being named Vigo before? What is that about?
Well, they changed the actors of everyone except Vaughn, so...
Is that something on Idris Elba that he just couldn't learn a new name? I mean, there are, you know, like Bob Newhart. It's like, you gotta call me Bob, otherwise I'll just never get my lines right. I tell ya. This was an interesting... Actually, it wasn't as bad as I thought, but it was a bit of a train wreck. It was a train wreck, but it wasn't as big a train wreck as I thought. Let me...
Here's a story for you. Podcaster watches one of his favorite series and enjoys podcasting each well-crafted episode and enjoys how the whole thing hangs together and actually builds up to some kind of, for once, some kind of satisfying finale, and enjoying that delightful aftertaste. His friend then gets him to watch the American remake, a pilot for the American remake of this show. Oh my God. I mean, did they get anything right?
I'm gonna take a little detour here for a second because it's germane to what we're going to talk about. There is a TV series which you may not be familiar with. Wouldn't surprise me. Some of our listeners will be, called Dark Shadows. I may have mentioned it in the past.
I have heard of it.
You have heard of it. Okay, it is a 1960s U.S. soap opera. I mean, very, very, the five-day-a-week kind, low-budget soap opera. And it was originally intended to be a typical soap opera where a young girl goes to a sort of remote New England town and everybody has a secret. But, you know, it's the usual kind. Somebody accidentally killed somebody. Somebody's having an affair with somebody. Somebody's, the usual soap opera kind of thing. And the show was kind of tanking. And so they came up with this sort of crazy, sort of supernatural plot line. And the ratings kind of went up. So they thought, well, that's a good idea. And when that finished, then they came up with another idea. And they said, let's introduce a vampire into the show. And this is where the show starts for most people, with the introduction of Barnabas Collins, the vampire. And spanning over several years. But the key part was that when he arrived in town, he'd been there for hundreds of years, but he had been recently resurrected. He meets a woman who works in a diner, Maggie Evans, and she is the spitting image of his fiancée, some tragic love affair back when he was alive. And so he sets about trying to convert her into a vampire, etc. And then she quits the show, and there's the main star of the show is this girl who's the governess in the family, and her name's Victoria Winters. And so then he starts kind of following up with her. And then, but basically everyone agrees that after the fact, it would have made far more sense in the first place if Victoria Winters had been the reincarnation of his lost love, Josette Dupree. Now, but, you know, that's how it goes. You're making a show, you do things, you get some new ideas, you throw them in there, and then eventually you get this sort of hodgepodge of things as time goes by. In the 1980s and 1990s, they tried to remake Dark Shadows, same people making the show. And so they combined all these plot lines together and redid them so that all the pieces made more sense in their mind. And the show tanked sort of miserably, but it was beautifully done. It was much better than the horribly made 60s soap opera. But it was the same story, but they've, you know, taken pieces here and there and rearranged them. And so if you're familiar with it and you watch it, you're like, no, that's not right. But yet it kind of is. And that's what this show is. It feels like somebody sat down with all... I'm not saying they're trying to make it... They did make it right. I'm just saying somebody sat down with all six episodes and said, we have to cram most of that in a pilot. And, you know, we need to interconnect it more. We need to make sure that that instead of just some random guy that they chase down on the street, it needs to be the motorcyclist. And Jack, no, Vigo needs to be stuck in some way into the storyline with the guy who gets the car burst open and catches on fire. None of the changes make sense, though.
Well, I don't think they're good changes. I think one of the things that this seems to me episodes 1 and 2. I don't know about all of it being combined in here, but clearly you have at least part of that. The storyline in Nomine Patris of having a vampire, the guy whose skin gets burnt, but when the motorcyclist smashes the window, who is disfigured, but who has still got a human friend helping him. That whole thing is clearly added to the basic storyline from Habeas Corpus of Jack, no, Vigo being tempted over, you know, however you want to look at it, or defecting over on his wedding day, and that whole thing. So you can see all of the plot strands in there. And one of the things I'm wondering, because I'm thinking, okay, so there are a number of obvious changes that have been made to the basic original Ultraviolet, because you kind of think, you know, there's episode one, they could just remake episode one like it was in the British version, and bam, there's your pilot. And clearly they haven't. They've changed a number of things in it. And adding that extra storyline, I wondered if it was a pacing thing, because the British one is, particularly looking at it now, when most UK TV has got a lot faster,
mm-hmm.
it still has that kind of 80s, 90s, quite sort of, it's very atmospheric, that opening sequence that you get. They don't hurl you into the action. You've got the guy looking at the sunset on the bridge, and the sinister vampires with their tinted windows and all of that stuff going. That's how the British one opens. The US one opens with a shot of some stripper's buttocks.
Score one to the Americans. No. but then right after that point, it's gone downhill from there.
Oh, it's not exactly subtle.
No. No, it's not.
I mean, there's one other point that you know, when you compare those openings, that I think absolutely stands out, and that is when you talk about Dark Shadows and the original versus the 80s version, and you describe the remake as being beautifully made.
Yeah,
this looks crap, really. I mean, I think I'm not going to find anything to praise about this. I'm going to have a go at the writing and the dialogue in particular. I'm going to have a go at the performances, the direction. What were they thinking? But in particular, how it looks, because Johan produces something beautiful in that first sequence here. If you look in particular where there are some things that are present in both episodes or in both versions, the storyline from In Nomine Patris with the guy whose skin has been burnt off by the sun coming through the car window, he never shoots that. It's all in shadows. The makeup is there. You get a hint of it, but only a tiny hint of it. This one, it's in full lighting, and it looks awful.
It looked terrible.
It looks terrible.
It looked like he had a black piece of leather or something stuck to his face, or it looked like it stuck up instead of cut down into the flesh. Which obviously it did, because they didn't cut into the actor's face. But I mean, good makeup would have.
Well, yeah,
could have done something with it.
Good makeup could have done something, but wow, good lighting, or you know, less lighting.
It is very industrial American television lighting, which there's a period of time when it just was no imagination in lighting.
But the United States. the guy who produced this, who I have some respect for, in the sense that in retrospect his comment on it was, "We screwed it up." He worked as a writer and a producer on the early X-Files stuff, where it was all kind of shady lighting and those big
before
torches.
Or after this?
Well, before this, because this
really
this was made in 2000. So this is, this is near the end of the X-Files.
I'm not. You're right. X-Files is very well done,
I think you can see its influence on the British version of it. If you look at the British show, you've got the idea essentially of a unit that is investigating something that is essentially paranormal. It can't have escaped anyone's notice that, the X-Files was big in the UK.
I used to subscribe to American Cinematographer, and to my recollection, the only time they ever talked about television, they talked about the X-Files, because the X-Files stood out. I forgot what they used to call the cinematographer and the lighting, the director of photography, the Prince of Darkness or something like that, because he was so good at those pools of light and, setting the mood and being able to see what you needed to see. But, it was the outlier in television at that time. We've gone through phases. If you go back into the 60s when things were shot on film, sometimes you would find shows that did a really lovely. If you look at first season Star Trek, there's lots of gobos, there's lots of shadows, there's lots of interesting design. And then as they got different cinematographer by the third year, it was dull, flat, boring lighting. And videotape shows were mostly dull, flat, boring lighting. And so it felt like, if I wouldn't have said 2000s, I would have pegged it somewhere in the early 90s or late 80s, but it felt like just, bog standard American TV cinematography. Set the lights here, don't bother to move them, shoot the show. But it wasn't finely crafted by any stretch of the imagination. Competent, but not finely crafted. In that respect, I could see everything. Bar the point where
which would have been great if it had been a chat show.
Yeah, bar the point where the makeup on the guy, which was stood out as astonishingly bad, I will say.
Yeah, but I'm going to pick on a couple of other things because especially when a show has taken something really special and ground it into dust. It wasn't right at the beginning, but that sequence in the club or wherever it is that they're having this stag night thing. Later in the episode, John goes and has a look at videotape that was taken, mm-hmm. and he sees himself pulling the girls off. Jax or Vigo.
Second worst acting to nothing ever.
Second
worst.
It's like, I am a mime.
The worst was Kirstie O'Neilly at the end doing the fake hugging.
Yes. Yes. Again, that, for gonna say, it's the same thing. It's a choice about what you show. And it's same thing in the sense of this is what they did with the makeup. They chose to brightly light it and have it center stage. Similarly, they show that kind of physical contact. But of course, there is no good way of doing it. There is no good way of doing it. Another point in the police station, one of the early scenes where with Vaughn, mm-hmm. his jacket's open to see the crucifix.
That's subtle, wasn't it?
Except the shot doesn't fit. Look at the shot. He's not opening his jacket. He kind of turns away and he's adjusting his tie. But you cut to a shot of his jacket falling open and seeing the crucifix. It doesn't fit with what's around it. It's terrible editing. I think it was added in because they felt. I wonder if it's even the same shot of the crucifix from later because they felt they wanted to play up that point about the nature of Vaughn
Well,
at this point in the show, but it is incompetent. When you say this is competently done, I don't know.
Well, it wouldn't win any awards. So let's put it that way. I've seen more incompetent programs.
You've watched pretty much all of The Man from Atlantis.
I would say Man from Atlantis was actually sort of competent. Was competently put together. It's just not good. I mean, there's the technical. You got it on shot, and you got the people in the shot, and you got it edited together. And there's that. And then there's that you've chosen some very poor choices. That's stylistic. That's the artistic side. And you can do Plan 9 from Outer Space, and you can see what not competently shot is. And then, look beyond. But
well, all right. I give them that they managed to point the cameras at the actors and press the old button.
You got the sound. You can hear them.
You can hear them. But a lot of the time, don't you wish you couldn't?
Sometimes. Now, I will say, I'm going to give one thing. Not saying exactly I liked it. I did like it, kind of. It didn't make any sense. I did, in fact, like the shot where Vaughn shot the motorcyclist behind the train.
Yes.
That was the only sequence in the entire show that I felt like somebody was trying to do something artistic. That somebody sat down for a few seconds and said, what would make an interesting shot? That would be kind of interesting. Of course, the fact that everyone on that train just watched him murder somebody as it zung by, who obviously had a much clearer view than John did, because he's looking through two sets of windows moving fast, and those people are just looking through one window going past somebody committing murder. So, in a lighted station.
That's okay. I think that's okay, because what are they going to do about it?
No. Yeah, really.
They might tell someone, and that person might get hold of the videotape, and they'll review the videotape, or they'll look for a body or any kind of physical evidence of anything. There's not going to be anything there. It was a collective hallucination. Whatever. I can kind of do that. And I think it played to Idris Elba's strength, because he looked pretty damn menacing striding along in his coat with that big old gun.
He seemed a lot more two-dimensional in this than he did in the British version, too.
He did look a bit like, what the hell is going on here?
So that was not...
But that might have been to fit in with the performances of everyone else, which was... I mean, God, this guy who they got... So, first of all, you guys have had a bit of Fry and Laurie over there on PBS or something, I take it.
Yeah, we've seen some Fry and Laurie.
So you remember the sketches with the two guys in the leisure centre? Damn it, John! Damn it! Six times round the car park and back again. This was that. It was all I expected him to start going, look out of that window and tell me what you see. I see Utoxeter. She actually says... Damn it, John! I mean it, John. You stay away. God,
there were some very bad lines, like they can't, they don't know, they can't, they can never know, or whatever it is.
But it was also what they made of them. That guy
refused to say actor.
Yeah, whatever his name is, who played the main, who played John, this was Eric Thal, who I'd never heard of before. He appeared to have been chosen largely because he had a fringe that was a bit like Jack Davenport's fringe, only massive, because his ability in terms of acting was not in evidence. I mean, he may be a great actor, but it was not in evidence.
Do you think he was putting on a fake accent? Because I kind of felt like he was trying to sound like a New York cop, and he might not be from New York.
Possibly. I mean,
something unnatural about the way he spoke. That's about the best I can put on it.
It certainly came across the way Fry and Laurie. Now, of course, Hugh Laurie can actually do, as it turns out, he did House, and
it's not
so
bad.
It proved that he could do an American accent. But
it's not bad.
But that wasn't the point in the sketches. The point was that, I wonder, but I don't know, because I've never seen him before. No idea who he was.
Well, back to your earlier point about whether you think it's pacing. I certainly think there's something to that. We have, when Ultraviolet got commissioned, it would almost certainly have been commissioned based on, well, you know, whatever the criteria is that the BBC uses to commission a program. And they commissioned it for six parts. That wasn't BBC?
No.
No.
Channel 4.
Well, bully for them.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even notice the commercial breaks.
On the DVD. Oh, I see what you mean. You didn't notice the structuring.
Didn't notice the structuring, yeah. I didn't notice You kind of get those awkward spots in Doctor Who where they just sort of cut away to a commercial and you go, yeah, that wasn't the place. But whatever structure, I'm guessing that they probably said, yep, here's your money, go make six episodes. Because that seems to be the system. Well, of course, that is not the system here. The system here is you make a pilot to try to convince somebody to give you the money to make the rest of the episodes.
Well, the system here might be, you make a pilot to convince people to give you the money for six episodes.
Well, clearly that's what this was, though, because they got the money to make one and no more. And they handed it to somebody, and somebody said, no, thanks. I think we'll pass on that one. But yes,
I've got a website here that says, I can't verify it, but it says that in May, Fox announced that it would be shown, there would be a series, and then dropped it. So it got quite a long way down the line somehow.
Yeah, how I don't know. But you're still, you know, the notion of a pilot is to convince somebody to give you more money, and
yeah,
they probably felt that there wasn't enough there in them. I disagree, but they probably felt there wasn't enough in the first episode. There's too much mystery of what the heck's going on and not enough answers to what's going on. And they probably felt they needed to, I hate to say it, but tighten it up, so speed it up, so that by the end of the pilot, you have enough information that you know everything that's going on. There can't be any more mystery in an American television series that's going to continue on. You get all that done on day one. Here's the explanation, and now let's have some fun. Do adventures.
I'm not sure about that, because I think the first episode of the British version is actually very well done, in the sense that it establishes what you need to understand for how the rest of the show is going to work. So, okay, it's not a pilot in the sense of trying to present what a typical episode is going to be like. This is the show I'm making, give me a load of money to make a load more like this. But by the end of the episode, you know what the unit is that Vaughan and Angie and Pierce are working for. You understand that it's about Mike going to work for it. The storyline with Jack has been wrapped up in such a way that you understand there is this menace, or whatever it may be, but that, you know, you understand, at least you get a sense of what the mystery is about the Code Fives. Yeah, you don't get all the answers, but you get a sense of what the mystery is. And in this one, I think it's much less tight in terms of that. There are changes in this, because obviously what we get is a load more of the Code Fives, or they call them leeches. There's a whole extra bunch, and we get this blinking lair of vampires.
Nest. Correct term for a thing of vampires is a nest.
Nest. I thought it was vipers, but anyway.
Vampires, whatever.
This brightly lit place where you have a collection of them. And to me, that undermines the sense of there being this wider community, which is this kind of very sinister, pervading force that runs all the way through the British series, precisely because it works in the British series because we don't get to see it, and in the American series it doesn't seem relevant because we've instead got this small group of chums who they're busy trying to make sympathetic by having the kind of vampire love story going on, and it's that group and the members of that group who are important, rather than the leeches as a race, as a force.
I thought during the original series that, and I think I mentioned it, but I don't know, maybe I didn't. I thought it was an interesting, and I felt it was a stylistic choice, that we only ever see one at a time. But even down,
yeah, you did. Yeah.
Even down into the final episode when they resurrect Jack, as soon as they do, they shoot the other one. So we still only have one on screen at any given time, really, or one interacting anywhere at any given time. And it's obviously here they've decided that they need to humanize them. And there's the question.
Yeah, well,
are
yes,
they trying
they
to
do.
Humanize them? So that, are they trying to very unsubtly hit us over the head? You know, you should really be thinking about the moral issues of these. Are they? Because Vaughn even says it. Or Lise says it, you know, we're not murderers. And I forgot what Vaughn's yes. word was.
another unsubtle.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, we are.
Piece of dialogue.
Yeah, he knows darn good and well he's killing people. But, even if they are vampire people.
I think there is some kind of shift here. The effort is to make the tension between, you've got the kind of the group of vampires who are intended to be more identifiable, easier to relate to as individuals, at least. And in the original series, you didn't, because, and I think this shows why it's such a good decision, but because, as you say, that stylistic choice, only ever show one vampire at once, get the sense of them as a race, you didn't get that. But what you did get instead was the moral question, which was always very, very prominent because of the kind of the zeal of our heroes and the kind, essentially the it's uncompromising because of the stakes involved in the conflict, which is a kind of I've called it a religious conflict, but mm-hmm. it's a fight for survival. Mm-hmm. At least that's how it's being seen by the sides involved. So that moral sense is very prominent there. To me, this feels like a softening because they're trying to get the conflict from somewhere else, which is making the characters making both sides more identifiable. But at the same time, they're softening them because I don't get the sense that our heroes are quite the same hard nut zealots that they were in the British version.
No, I think I agree. And you know, just to carry on, when we only can see one, when we can only interact with one of the leeches at any given time, we only ever see the face that they allow the humans to see. If you put two of them together to interact, even if it's only unintentionally, you are seeing a different face that they present to each other. And that's
a great point.
That's what we've got in spades here. Is because you throw them in a room in the vamp lair, vamp nest, and they can, you know, oh, well, we've been in love for hundreds of years, and oh, she'll come over. And so you get to see more of the tempting, and you get to see them interacting with each other, and it just, it fails. It's almost like they're trying to give unfair balance. I think it's better if we're the good guys. In real life, if we are the good guys and we believe that we are the good guys, and we should be in a position to question the motives and try to understand the opposite side. And maybe it's evil, maybe it isn't evil. It's the act that we ourselves can question that gives us some, and I don't mean necessarily anyone, some sort of moral authority. If you recognize that you may not understand what's going on, but that you are acting in ignorance, and these people they've given it undue balance between the two sides by making them just the same as we are. They're just in love.
But I'm not sure that because you did get some kind of opportunities to identify with the leeches in the British version, but usually that was through the relationship that some human had with, in Nomine Patris, where you have the city trader woman and the, mm-hmm. So you have her relationship in the, and I forget which episode it was now, but in the one with the barrister who had been unable to conceive
children, right?
And you get that scene in the woods where she's dying and all of that.
But it's still.
I think you get the you get the emotional life of them, but the perspective that you get, and I think that point you made is so good, that you see it only from one side. You see it only from the human side. And it's very unvarnished in showing both the kind of heroic actions of the human side, but also the kind of morally questionable, the lengths to which they will go. And you have to ask the questions, you know, is this justified? Are they like us or are they not like us?
It challenges the audience more.
It does, because...
And American TV is not known for that.
No, and the difficult thing would be you would actually have to question your own side in some way when you are engaged in a conflict like this, and the reason for it is because right is on our side, we are the triumphant ones, the means justify the ends, etc., etc., etc. What it's asking you to do is question that. And yes, in our British version, in the end, probably on balance, the way it kind of concludes suggests that actually right was on our side. But mm-hmm. I still think it's a powerful question to have asked, because at the time when a lot of these actions took place, it wasn't clear that all you had was these characters' absolute kind of confident certainty that through whatever it was. And I think this is in particular why it's such a mistake that the US version doesn't have a Father Pierce character.
That's
it's
interesting
that
too.
Absolute faith that their position is correct, and it doesn't depend on evidence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm gonna invoke, I forget which law I'm about to invoke here and cause this the whole podcast to crash, but I'm going to invoke Hitler here for a second. I am going to. You know, you said that we do get some of the humanizing, if you will, of the leeches in their interactions with the banker and interactions with the judge, and how they seem to have a fondness and affection for them. But I'm sure that Hitler's Alsatians thought he was a great guy. And again, it's the face that he shows his dog. So, I mean, they love him like pets.
You're absolutely right in that point. You're absolutely right in that point. The thing is, we don't know,
right?
Because we can still project onto their behavior the possibility that they are behaving as we would.
Yeah,
but you can't be sure of it.
Hey, there's the word. We're anthropomorphizing them.
Maybe we are. And people like Pierce and Vaughn, they're absolute certainty is that is in fact what someone like Mike is doing when he says, hang on a minute, you know, maybe actually their intention is for peace and to make everything good in the end. And their view is no, you know, any kind of human behavior or emotional, you know, the normal identifiable emotional responses is as a result of their showing you the face that they want you to see.
Okay, let's ask this question. I remember this discussion well. We couldn't remember in episode 2, we couldn't quite fathom why, we understood why, well, he killed the motorcyclist, we thought that was pretty much revenge. But he cured the girl, who was sort of the innocent victim, which seemed like a mercy. But then she went after Mike, which mm-hmm. may or may not have been a mercy. So the whole thing became confused again. I'm not really sure what their motivations were. Couldn't see anything here other than guilt in this one. Really sorry I ran over you, but oops. And I guess we'll heal you. I didn't see any ambiguity there at all, right?
Yeah. I mean, but again, partly because they crammed it into the... from the second episode into the... in addition to everything they had in the first episode going into the pilot.
Because it is the motorcyclist's fault that they broke the window. I mean, for crying out loud, he was a jerk, and he pulled out a lead pipe, and he started smashing somebody's car. And we shouldn't have any sympathy for him. But in the British version, we had the girl there who was kind of like, oh, Billy, whatever you have, don't do that. It's not worth it. And it's like, she
is
the innocent victim.
And that is the difference, because you've conflated these two characters, and now it doesn't really make any sense.
And then we get to convert him also into the guy that has to do the chase through the subway, which is just stolen mm-hmm. right out of, I mean, it was stolen right out of the British version, right down to running over the guy on the bicycle, as I recall, when they were doing the chase and crossing the street and into the subway. I mean, I wouldn't say it was exactly shot for shot, but it was pretty darn lifted.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And, you know, is that just cutting down budget? Well, if we hire fewer actors, if we do it this way, I don't know.
I don't know because they obviously you lose Father Pierce. Mm-hmm. You lose the
woman.
Well,
you can't have religion. You can't have a religious guy doing this.
But yeah,
in
but
the
you
United
do.
States.
You have the hospital, the Sacred Heart, or whatever it's called, has all of the kind of. It's a Catholic hospital, but with a huge. Or I don't know. Maybe this is normal because we don't have these in our NHS hospitals. But all of the symbols and everything, and of course the fact that. That because there is no Pierce, Vaughan has to be carrying around this crucifix, and we have to have it spliced into shots where it obviously doesn't fit.
Yes, and of course, if we didn't notice it, it was completely ineffectual because there was one hanging on the wall in plain sight of the motorcyclist as well.
Yeah,
as and walked out the door. I mean, that was it's like I go, well, how are they going to get into this room with that there? If our heroes think
indeed it has, yeah, and yeah, I mean, I that was it interesting and something that we discussed about whether the kind of religious stuff worked because
people feel like it does in this show and
leeches believed it worked. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if we had time to explore it. I mean, I like the fact that in the British version, the headquarters of the
Inquisition.
The Inquisition, yeah, for want of a better word, were very, very kind of anonymous kind of corridors. And in a way, a bit like the FBI offices in The X-Files, very kind of this is a workplace and mm-hmm. there's nothing particularly special about it. And there weren't all of these kind of Christian symbols hanging about the place. And indeed, a lot of the time, Pierce doesn't wear his dog collar or whatever, so there's no... physical or visible indication that he is a priest, mm-hmm. which gives you some quite effective scenes where someone they suspect of being a leech kind of shies away from him. And again, you raise that question, okay, well, if they don't know that he's a priest, is there something else about him that gives them that indication and what else is going on there? And I don't know why they bothered with the religious stuff in this, because, like you say, it doesn't seem to have any effect. And all of those interesting subtleties are completely lost.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, Pierce is a little bit, as you say, Pierce is kind of not necessarily the good guy in the British version. And, boy, I can't imagine them trying to run a primetime television show in this country where the priest might be questionable. back then. Nowadays, obviously, he's a sodomite or something, but that would be different. But no, that's just they kind of hands off on that, and then when they do have them, they're kindly people like the guy on Firefly or Father Mulcahy and MASH or mm-hmm. something. I don't think you could have a fanatic. At least not a Christian fanatic. Could probably have a fanatic from some other faith because obviously they're all wrong, right? But
but that's why I mean, in a way, that to me is why watching Ultraviolet this time round has had such resonance because of the kind of level that the discourse about Islamic extremism and terrorism in this country has reached. And I'm sure it's the same in the US, I think even more because of the kind of the religious attitudes and some of the extraordinary things, I have to say, that some of your elected representatives come out with. You guys need this.
I can tell you one thing. You know, in our representative government, there is one demographic group that is overrepresented in our legislature, and that's utter morons. They are overrepresented in Congress. There's no doubt about it. Yay.
But while I think there may be reasons why, and yes, you may be absolutely right, you know, that the Pierce character wouldn't fly in a US version for those reasons and for commercial considerations rather than, you know, the fact that actually that's to me, that seems a story that the American audience damn well needs to see. But OK, commercial reasons make it unpalatable. I'm not sure that the choice is simply as saying we don't have the budget for this many cast, because you've suddenly got the captain who John works to, and apparently Neely is also a police officer.
I think his name is Jack, which makes things more confusing.
Yeah, that adds to it. Also, you've got all of these extra vampire characters that you didn't have in the British version. So you've got a sizable cast there. It's not like you're cutting back in that sense. To me, it seemed like the British cast, they managed to get away with fewer actors than they did in this pilot.
Also a true statement. I'm just trying to think that if they had taken, you know, they had a lot of actors already, so you could be, you know, let's combine the motorcyclist with the runner and the girl, because, you know, it's either...
Because we want to introduce these other characters. But to me, I couldn't see where that was going. I didn't see how that would serve the series had it taken off.
The extra girl? The extra vampires?
The extra vampires, the police captain.
I can actually tell you what I think. Could be wrong, but I will go out on a limb. One, obviously Viggo was going to be a continuing foil, so a moral quandary for our hero. But as we've said all throughout the show of the original, this show is presenting you with something you can think about with regards to your moral quandary of you know, are we in the right? And for an American television show of that age, I am shocked that they even paid lip service to the idea, let alone trying to build it into the show, which is what they did by unsubtly showing us how human the vampires are, you know, how much they love each other and you know, just want to whatever the heck it is that they want to do and are persecuted. That is not typical. They should just be the bad guys at this stage of the game. They should be the villains in X-Files who are not in any way sympathetic ever, if you think about it. They are all bad guys, and that's what these vampires should be, but they have gone out on the limb and said what we can take from the British version is that maybe there's some moral ambiguity here. They've done it in the wrong way, but I applaud them for trying.
There's a very different approach to Viggo, or whatever his name was, the originally Jack character, in the sense that quite clearly in the British version he is a shit, and he strolls off on the eve of his wedding, and the reasons that he doesn't turn up are clearly down to the fact that he's
bent.
Not a good guy. Not a good guy. And in this, because you introduce the storyline with the motorcycle guy and being stuck in the car or whatever, you give him a stronger reason for not actually turning up at the church. And you also therefore don't get the showdown between John or Mike. He doesn't get to kill him at the end. Mm-hmm. So.
Did you?
You're setting him up as someone who is much more identifiable.
Did you feel like in this that there was some additional story that we weren't privy to between Viggo and Pasty Guy? Because he seemed to be really in touch with him.
That's a good point, because I think
they seem like that was my best friend.
That wasn't in the pilot. It wasn't in what we saw. In the British version, you have the whole counterfeiting thing. And as Mike uncovers what Jack has been up to, you discover a bit about the fact that he'd obviously been involved with the counterfeiters. Or in fact, you know, they were the leeches, and he had been planning to go over for some time. And that also comes across in the exchange in their showdown. So, in a sense, that would translate across to this guy who Viggo appears to know, having been his contact, having been someone he has known for a long time, who he has been making plans with to join them. But I'm not sure that that is... I think I may be inferring that from the storyline we got in the British version, and I'm not sure it's actually present in what we see on screen. Is that
I actually at one point thought that we were going to find out before he mentioned being a vampire for centuries. There was a moment where I thought we were going to reveal that Pasty Guy was Vigo's long-lost brother. They were so close. I mean, they were much more, I don't want to use the word intimate, but his interactions with that guy were much more warm and open and loving than they were with his best friend, mm-hmm. partially because of the quality of the acting, perhaps. But I just felt like, I didn't quite feel like he was going to reach over and kiss him, but, you know, I thought he was going to, damn it, Pasty, you're my little brother, and I'm not going to let you die. That's what I felt like the next line was going to be before they started spouting about how they'd been at it for hundreds of years. I'm like, okay, why is he so invested in this guy? What is it? Is it? I wish I'd known that. That would have maybe... I did think there was an interesting parallel that was almost word for word. Lise tells John... Well, it's hard getting those names right. Lise tells John that the leeches will tell you anything you want to hear. They'll lie to mm-hmm. you and tell you anything you want to hear. And then Vigo turns around and says exactly the same thing to John. They lie and they'll tell you anything you want to hear to believe this. So, an unsubtle way of pointing out that we're just the same. Two brothers fighting on the opposite side of the American Civil War. That's what this is. This is classic. Yeah.
But because otherwise the line, they'll tell you anything you want to hear. In the British version, that is setting up this whole thing of one reading of everything we see of the leeches is that it's all done for how they're seen, for a purpose in terms of coming across in a certain way. But mm-hmm. because, as you pointed out in the pilot, we're actually seeing the actual relationships between them and some genuine interactions. Yeah, there is no longer any question about that.
I was hoping when we see the scene where Jack's still feeding him, or Vigo is still feeding him, and they're talking about, oh, she, you know, Neely will come across just like she did. At that scene, I thought, you know, he's still a human. They could be totally lying to him. But in the scene when Vaughn's people were coming in and were going to gun him down and she wouldn't leave him and he's like, no, go on without me, love again. That blew that hope away completely.
Yeah.
Then that was like, nope, that was actually their thinking. And that was me reading the British show into it, because I was still trying to hold on to that notion up to that point that they're just leading Vigo along and that they could be lying to him, because that's what I expect from this show. And it's not what I got. So
I think there fundamentally is two problems. One is they just don't get what was good about the British show. And the other is they do everything badly. It wouldn't matter so much that, you know, the acting or the cinematography or the rest of it was as bad as it is, if they had understood more what this show was about. Because you think, well, those are things they could fix. You know, the show might have got better. But because they didn't understand the fact that the changes they were making actually undermined what was interesting about the British show, it stopped the thing hanging together anymore.
And I do want
to... It's like they drove a stake through its heart.
I do want to say, though, that, you know, at the beginning where you were talking about how, you know, a friend forced you to watch this, ruining your memory, I just want to say I'm doing you a favor, because now I know you'll have to go back and watch the other one again. And so I'm giving you that opportunity. So let's just try
just
to put
to
the right spin
the
on that. the thing. I will say there was one thing in this that I'm – one last thing that I just about threw a rock at the TV. There is one thing that occurs in TV shows about that period. It's a show I know you like. House is guilty of this, and I detest it. I detest it with a passion. And that is I think we're going to play a little song at the end of the episode so that we can encapsulate the emotional mood of this show for you in case we didn't have enough story to put in here, and you're too crap as an audience to have understood what was going on. I hate those musical interludes at the end of shows. Hate, 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 hate them. I'm glad it's gone, or if it's not, I don't see it very often anymore.
The music on the British version of Ultraviolet is excellent.
Oh, no, I'm...
No. Yeah. No, I think music down as, you know, another kind of technical
I didn't notice any music in the American version until we got to the song at the end when he's looking wistfully through the window and like, oh, I better leave her alone. I didn't notice any other music in the show at all.
Well, I noticed the incidental music and I didn't think it was as good, but the British show... The score is purely the incidental music. There are no kind of commercial tracks,
and it's good. It's eerie and it kind of fits the mood. I do remember it from the original, but here, that was the only thing I noticed, and it was jarred into place. Anyway, the characters, Neely, obviously there's no John and Neely aren't pining away for each other in this one, or John isn't pining away for her, so there was like one line that might have implied that, but I don't think it was real.
It didn't come across, but that may be down to the actors.
Could be down to the... Well, Jack Vigo did say, you know, something about just because you probably regret because I got there first or something like that.
Yeah.
But the response from our hero was so dead like a frog face that I couldn't tell if that hit the mark or whether that was ribbit.
Yes, well, quite.
Let's see. Vaughn's character was more two-dimensional. Lisa's character was, wow, was she a font of exposition?
Yeah. Though, in terms of acting, she was okay, I thought. In fact, she seemed very familiar, and I didn't recognise most of the actors in it, apart from Idris Elba. Turns out that she, Joanna Going, was in the second series of the House of Cards, the US remake of House of Cards. Hey, how to remake, take a really good British show with Susanna Harker in it, by the way, and remake it in the US. House of Cards. It's not sci-fi, so we can't really excuse talking about it, but that's how it's done properly, ladies and gentlemen.
And not with the remake of Coupling or Fawlty Towers or, let's see, what other shows have they tried to remake over here that have failed miserably? Now, it's a long history of that failure. And it's all down to the fact that apparently you people talk so funny nobody over here can understand it. At least that's what I'm told.
I don't get this, but that's like people over here. They will watch the English language versions, which are often inferior, of imported TV series from, like, European TV series. Mm-hmm. The Killing, for example. It wasn't a British remake. It was an American remake in that case. People don't like reading subtitles, and I don't get that
this is one that we can share with the British and the Australians and the English-speaking language of the world. There is something about English speakers that don't like subtitles. Man, I think that's fairly common. Is it the arrogance of being a native speaker of the language that rules the world, or is it something else? I don't know, clearly
it morphs into, not only do I not like it if it's not in my language, but actually I don't like it if it's not in my accent or something pretty close to my accent.
Can get that way too, yeah.
I want to be able to hear the words. I can see the difficulty. We had a show over here probably on around the same time as the original Ultraviolet called Rabsy Nesbitt, which was a sitcom where the dialogue was so heavily Glaswegian that it was actually quite hard to make out what was being said a lot of the time. Now I can see some of the difficulties in that. You have to tune your ear to it, and you have to work at that. I find at risk of sounding like a grumpy old man, from time to time, some of these modern young actors mumble and don't enunciate as much as the kind of the stage actors who, you know, the classic television of the 60s and 70s were all from people who came up through rep and everything and had this training and would have enunciated in order for an audience in an unmiked theatre to be able to hear them. So they mm-hmm. had no kind of problem with that. And that mumbling or setting the level so the music is too high can be a bit annoying, or maybe my hearing is just going. But I'm very unsympathetic to this idea of, well, I need this show remade in my language. I won't watch it because, for us, it's the equivalent of saying we won't watch it because all the actors have Australian accents, or indeed American accents. We that would be ludicrous.
If your brain, I'm sure somebody's done an fMRI and found out this is true, but do you have to engage more of your brain to watch TV or a movie if you're using subtitles?
Well, presumably, I mean, you are.
Does it decrease your comprehension? Does it increase your comprehension? Do you lose some of the subtlety of what's on the screen? For example, do you miss things that are more cinematic? I mean, I really don't know. It doesn't bother me to read subtitled shows. I do find
I'm sure you can't
took your eyes away from them. I mean, we watch a lot of Japanese stuff with the kids, and you know, you can't get up and go refill your glass of water without pausing the TV because you can't, you know, follow the story by just sound and look away, or you can't, you know, your email ring dings and you can't look down. You have to be focused on it, or you don't.
You focus in a different way. Yes, if your point is, do you lose something by reading the subtitles that you wouldn't, you would get if you were a native speaker? Yes, I'm sure there is something you lose. Do you lose more if some cretin from your own country remakes it in an inevitably inferior way in your own language? Definitely. It's worth making the effort to see the original. Not in every case, you know, this isn't a hard and fast rule, but generally you can worry about losing something through having to read the subtitles because, to your regret, you don't happen to speak Danish or whatever. But at the same time, that doesn't mean, you know, produce a kind of flavorless version in your own language that chucks out all the kind of atmosphere and everything else that the original might have had.
All right, so I didn't ask up front. I'll ask now because I'm not sure where you sit on the fence here on this one. Did you like this pilot or did you not like it?
Give me my garlic. Grenade and my carbon bullets, and I will go out and hunt this pilot down and kill it.
Did you notice they didn't make anything at all of the guns with the video scopes?
Yeah.
He did mention the carbon bullets, but then the rest of it, they just kind of blew it away, and they didn't even have a little scene where he looks at it and goes, oh, good, video screen. Could it be the American?
The action.
Sorry.
I would have thought this may be a stereotype, but American TV series often are very good at action stuff. The British version of Ultraviolet didn't have a lot of action. We talked about the fact that it was quite a cerebral series, it was quite dialogue heavy. In the British version, in that first episode, you have quite good action sequences, I think, with the garlic grenades and jumping out through the window. In that, and all of the detail about the weaponry and the grenade he almost manages to blow up Jack with at the end. So, actually, in an area where I'd expect the US pilot score, it really didn't do very well.
No. Like I say, they seem to gloss over it mostly. Yeah. And they didn't mention
wasted.
Like I said, they didn't talk about the video camera, which maybe they felt that was obvious. Oh, vampires, video camera, see it. You know, we see the guy's not in it. Oh, that makes perfect sense. Okay. And you don't bother to kind of, you know, dwell on it. But like the sequence where John is holding a gun on Viggo at the end, there's no evidence he has carbon bullets there.
Yep. Yeah.
No mention of it. There's no mention of Viggo going, you know, that gun's not going to work on me. Nothing like that. They just kind of, it's just not very well, just not very well thought out. And therein lies the crime. And not that there's anything wrong with the English version, because there isn't. It's a very good show. You know, wish it had gone on and answered a few more things in this story. It's not that it's a bad show, but you're given a chance to think about it and say, you know, could we tweak it a little bit and do, you know, maybe something that we didn't get quite right the first time through or the first episode or whatnot. And they utterly, completely failed at doing that. And second chances are good, but not when you know, I feel that way largely about reboots and remakes anyway, but sometimes they do a better job.
I think House of Cards is a great example of that, because if you're familiar with the original show, you can see certain things that run through, you know, it was originally a book and then it was a British TV show and now it's an American TV show. And you can see the storylines that run through, where you will expect certain things to happen. Spoilers, if you like, but they come up. And then...
Okay.
If you're an American viewer or just a viewer who hasn't seen the British version and you're coming fresh to the American version, it works in its own right, because they haven't followed the original slavishly. They've taken the things they like, but they built a good series around it. And if they had done that with this one, if they'd made changes and made it into a different show, if it had been a good show, I'd have been happy.
But alas, it wasn't.
It certainly wasn't.
So we have now finally put the tombstone on Ultraviolet, as it were. Run up the curtains, let the sunlight in. We are now truly through with it, except, of course, for Simon going out and rewatching it in a binge watch, probably, just to get the taste out of his mouth. But
to rinse my brain clean.
It's been an interesting journey. And it gives us a chance to pick on American television for a while, so that's all right too. Well, thank you for joining me through this this journey, despite the nightmare ending. And on this,
well, it's been a pleasure for the most part.
6 out of 7, right?
Exactly.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf. Oh, it's not that bad.